Welcome to the Embodiment Conference. This channel, Trauma and Social Change, it's absolutely the moment for that, isn't it? I'm Steve Hoskinson. I'm the founder of Organic Intelligence. I've been teaching in this area of trauma, embodiment, and social change for about 25 years. It's an honor, really, for us to be sponsoring this channel where we're going to hear a multiplicity of voice, all unique contributors to our collective understanding of how to move from trauma and support then social change. Our unique voice in organic intelligence has something to do with a koan that I'd like to present to you, which is trauma means unintegrated resource. And that's a koan, and if you'd like and are feeling intrigued about that riddle, then tune in to the post-trauma system development course that we are offering here. The coupon code that'll get you half off on that is ENJOY. Now, enjoy this next presentation, and we'll look forward to another meaningful time as we explore these topics, trauma and social change. Enjoy.
All right, so our next speaker is a master's student in clinical mental health counseling at Troy University in Tampa, Florida. She provides training and consultancy on suicide prevention, disability justice, body liberation, and the health at every size paradigm. She is a strong believer in the inherent worth and value of all body minds and hopes to create a world free from body shaming, ableism, and all other forms of oppression. It is a huge pleasure to have you here, Shira. Welcome, Shira Collings.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm super excited to be here, and thank you to everyone who came. I'm really excited to talk about this topic. If we can just show the slides, I can go ahead and get started. And feel free to introduce yourself in the chat if you want to. And in the meantime, I don't know if you can see, but back here is my cat, Franklin, and he'll be joining us, I think. We'll see. So the topic that I'll be presenting on is health at every size and body liberation. If we can have the next slide. So just to introduce myself first, to give you a little bit of background about myself and kind of the perspective that I'm coming from. I am a Jewish queer disabled grad student in clinical mental health counseling in Tampa, Florida. I strongly believe in the inherent worth of all bodies and minds, and I'm passionate about creating a world that's an inclusive place for all. And before beginning, I just wanna acknowledge that I'm a person within privilege, white privilege, and relative financial privilege. So we'll talk a little bit more about that, specifically the thin privilege aspect. Soon, but just that all kind of makes it easier for me to talk about these subjects and be heard more. And I just want to make sure to acknowledge that. Next slide. So a little bit about why this topic. As a person in eating disorder recovery, I know firsthand the pain and suffering that can come from having a difficult relationship with your body. And I feel strongly that every person deserves to feel at peace with your body. I really personally think that our body is kind of an inseparable part of us. It is part of who we are, part of our existence, shapes the way we think and the way we're treated and the way we perceive the world. So to be at war with our bodies or to dislike our bodies or to receive the message that our bodies are wrong is just really alienating a huge part of ourselves. So I just wanna start by asking, what is one thing that might be different for you in your life if you truly felt at peace with your body? Quit beating myself up. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, I think same. I'd have a lot more self-compassion. I'd feel safe. Wouldn't have to stuff emotions, numb with food. Yeah. Feel free to just keep thinking about that throughout the presentations. Relationships with others would differ as well. Yeah. So next slide. So just a little bit of a note on language before we continue. So during this presentation, I won't be using the terms overweight or obesity. I honestly feel uncomfortable even saying that. These terms are often stigmatizing and imply that being at a higher weight is inherently and universally unhealthy. So I'll be using the language recommended by the Association for Size Diversity and Health, people in larger bodies and higher weight people. A lot of activists have also chosen to reclaim the word fat as a neutral descriptor. Just some people are thin, some people are fat. It's totally fine. There's nothing wrong with any of it. So that will also be included. Next slide. So health at every size, I'm not sure if any of you have heard of it, but just kind of the basics is that it's a paradigm that promotes respect, inclusion, social justice, access to healthcare, and life-enhancing behaviors for people of all sizes. It represents a departure from a more conventional paradigm, which equates weight with health and idealizes thinness and weight loss. So before talking more about Haze, I just want to talk about kind of what the conventional paradigm looks like and why we need to move away from that. Next slide. So just some harms of the conventional paradigm, the paradigm that kind of equates weight with health and goes by BMI as kind of a way to judge whether people are healthy or how much people need to be eating. One of the major harms is weight stigma, that's also called sizeism or fat phobia. Basically, idealizing thinness and weight loss leads to the false generalization that thinness and weight loss are indicative of morality, self-discipline, and health. And this leads to a lot of prejudice and discrimination against higher weight people, both inside and outside of healthcare settings. Basically, people in larger bodies are assumed to lack self-discipline, are assumed to be lazy or not taking care of themselves, when in reality, weight really is not an indication of how somebody eats or how much someone exercises or how much self-discipline someone has or really any other aspect of their personality or their life. I think the conventional paradigm also promotes disordered eating. People are often encouraged to restrict their food intake, over-exercise, and engage in other behaviors to control their weight. This can lead to a very disordered relationship with food. Dieting tends to be encouraged, or a lot of times you'll see, quote, healthy eating encouraged, which is often code for just restricting certain food groups or not eating enough, basically. Trying to have an energy deficit, which how absurd is that when you really think about it, that what's encouraged is not taking in enough energy to do what you need to do in your daily life, to do all the things that make you and make your life great. We're encouraging people to not have enough energy for that. Next slide. Misdiagnosis is another really big harm. People in larger bodies are often told to lose weight to address any health concerns. Serious life-threatening issues have been overlooked and misattributed to weight. In addition, people in larger bodies are often assumed to not have restrictive eating disorders. There's this idea that restrictive eating disorders only occur if you're thin or always result in thinness. That's often not true. I think the most common forms of eating disorders and restrictive eating disorders are the ones that occur in people who are either higher weight or just would not be considered underweight. But that's often missed because of stereotypes that people with restrictive eating disorders are thin versus people who are fat always eat too much. And in embodiment and mental health spaces specifically, I've found that assumptions are often made that being a higher weight is indicative of trauma or psychological issues. That I hear the term food addiction sometimes thrown around, that if someone is at a higher weight, that means they're addicted to food. That means that they have some sort of psychological dysfunction, which is obviously a complete stereotype. And it's just inaccurate science. People often assume that it's been scientifically proven that being at a higher weight is the result of unhealthy habits and causes health problems. The reality is that body size is not an indicator of personal health, eating, or exercise habits. There's people who have restrictive eating disorders and are in higher weight bodies. There are people who exercise a lot, who eat very little, who are in higher weight bodies. There's people who eat a lot and are thin. So there's all sorts of factors that shape weight. A lot of them are genetic, that are really don't have anything to do with food intake or exercise. And I really want to emphasize that weight stigma and its consequences can be far, far, far more dangerous than being a particular body size. Weight stigma is pretty much always harmful, at least on some level. Being a particular body size is not necessarily harmful at all. Next slide, please. So I just want to show some statistics to kind of point out the harm that weight stigma does. The best known environmental contributor to the development of eating disorders is the socio-cultural idealization of thinness. Eating disorders are the second most fatal mental illness, surpassed only by opioid use disorder. 40 to 60% of elementary school girls are concerned about their weight. That's a lot. Over one half of teenage girls and nearly one third of teenage boys engage in disordered eating behaviors, including skipping meals, fasting, smoking cigarettes for weight loss, vomiting, and taking laxatives. So I want to let that sink in that such high rates of young people are engaging in behaviors that are harming their health, that have really high risks, that just make it hard to live a normal life, to be a normal kid and enjoy your life. And people are doing this because we've pushed this narrative that being thin is so good, being thin is so healthy. 13.2% of girls develop an eating disorder by age 20. Among adolescent males, the prevalence of eating disorders is 1.2% at 14 years, 2.6% at 17 years, and 2.9% at 20 years. That statistic is most likely a little bit low, or maybe a lot low, because men don't report eating disorders as much. They're not diagnosed in men as much, or boys. So that rate, we might find out that it's actually a lot higher. And 1 in 8 adults have had suicidal thoughts due to negative body image. So I just really want to emphasize that too, that maybe it doesn't affect someone's eating that much or that severely, but a lot of people are so distressed over how their body is perceived that they end up feeling like they want to take their own life. That's really serious. Next slide. So I just want to play a video. This is from the National Eating Disorders Association. And it just features some people talking about their experience of disordered eating.
Can we get our phones on silent, please, everybody? Take one, second sticks.
The first time I went on a diet, I was 8. And then I went on diets all the way until I was 18. I grew up in a family that's very, very weight and diet focused. And so my body was not accepted in my entire life growing up. I've also had an eating disorder for over 2 decades.
I was getting some new clothes for the new teaching job that I got. And I was publicly body shamed while I was shopping. There's this version of toxic masculinity where men aren't supposed to talk about how they feel. A lot of my guy friends are going to be like, oh, man up, or, you know, you need to go to the gym or suck it up. I didn't really need to hear that. I needed somebody to tell me that how I felt was okay.
It's something that happens all the time. That's because our world is built with thin people in mind. I think that if we don't talk about how weight stigma is impacting eating disorders, we're doing everyone a disservice.
It's hard to like tell a guy to accept his body when he doesn't feel like people even accept his skin tone. I really feel like a lot of women of color, or like a lot of men of color, are not even in the conversation most of the time.
We all deserve to be able to say, hi, I'm in pain, and be listened to. I saw these fat babes doing cool shit on the internet. And I was like, you know what? You know what I want to do? I want to make cool shit on the internet. If I could save a younger version of me or someone who like fits into my identities from all that pain and suffering and like exhaustion, like that's what I want to do with my time.
I wanted to kind of show my story. Sometimes Instagram is a highlight reel of everyone's perfect moments, but that's just not the reality. Everyone struggles and everyone goes through pain. And so I thought it was just really important to kind of call it out and be honest about what really goes on.
I created like a space where I take like body positivity and the thing that made me body confident, which was fashion, to show men of all shapes and sizes that they can feel confident in their bodies.
We have our own little corner of the internet. It's called the Mermaid Kingdom, and it is a space for empathy and compassion and caring for one another and knowing that at like the end of the day, someone is there.
I wish I could be the poster child for, you know, perfect recovery, but I feel like, honestly, recovery doesn't work like that. It's messy, it's long, it's complicated, it's painful.
So when people talk about body liberation, we're talking about people being able to get adequate medical care, no matter what size they are, people being able to get clothes no matter what size they are, people being able to have the space to be comfortable in their bodies no matter what size they are.
I encourage everyone to like really, you know, dig into what makes them feel positive. For me, it's like things like my Buzz Lightyear socks, you know, it's like, you know, my cool hats.
I just want people to know that it doesn't have to reach this scary point and that they're worthy of getting help just as they are right now.
Your body is never the issue, never has been, never will be.
Feel free to share your reflections and thoughts on the video, but I think it does a really good job showing that eating disorders affect people in all body sizes, but unfortunately that's not really talked about due to weight stigma. So I want to talk a little bit about specifically the intersection of weight stigma and embodiment, since we are at the Embodiment Conference. The conventional approach leaves really little room for embodiment. The body is really seen as something that needs to be controlled and overpowered by restriction, overexercise, and disordered eating. It's really creating a war against the body, alienating your body from yourself, stopping listening to what your body wants, and instead kind of imposing external values on it. And the body often fights back. It fights back through health issues, through tension, pain. A lot of, I think people don't often realize the impact that eating disorders can have on your health or any type of food restriction, regardless of what body size you're in. Even if someone is in a larger body and they're restricting their food intake, they can develop all sorts of really awful health problems and really awful mental health problems, suicidal ideation, anxiety, depression. And often they're just encouraged to keep on restricting. And so it just creates this perpetual war with the body. And I wanted to talk specifically about binge eating, that binge eating is often seen as something that's maybe like an addiction or like a lack of control, an impulse control issue. There's really good evidence showing that binge eating is the result of restriction, that it's often fueled by restriction. A lot of times, like physical restriction, depriving yourself of food. Other times, emotional restriction, just kind of shaming yourself for eating certain foods or shaming yourself for your body size. When the body feels deprived and when it's not getting enough nourishment, it will fight to eat. And fight to get some kind of caloric intake in. And that's often where binge eating comes from. And of course, people often feel very ashamed for that or are shamed by others. And then that leads them to restrict more and more. And so that can be very, again, just this constant mind-body war. Next slide, please. So I really see health every size as an alternative to that. It seeks to combat some of the issues created by our current paradigm, and it's currently widely used by eating disorder treatment professionals and facilities, as well as physicians, dietitians, and therapists. So let's go ahead and talk about some of these principles. Next slide, please. So the first principle is weight inclusivity, and that means accepting and respecting the inherent diversity of body shapes and sizes instead of idealizing or pathologizing specific weights. The principle is largely based on set point weight theory. Much like height, our bodies have a preset weight baseline hardwired into our DNA. How much we can change that weight without resorting to extreme dieting or disordered eating is pretty limited. I've heard it kind of compared to like shoe size. You can cram your foot into a smaller shoe, but it's going to be uncomfortable and it's not going to lead to long-term foot safety. So rather than focusing on changing our weight or cramming our foot into that tiny shoe, Hayes advocates for accepting our natural body size and just kind of eating in the way that feels comfortable and right, moving in the way that feels comfortable to us, and wherever the body settles is where it's supposed to be, kind of trusting the body's wisdom. Next slide, please. So this is an amazing video about that that was made by the Association for Size Diversity and Health. So if you can just play this.
There's a big problem at the center of our research on weight and health. What's the problem? Well, picture a society made up of dogs. Let's say poodles are the bossiest group. They're the ones you see down at the doggy park barking at all the other dogs about how to live their lives in order to be healthy. But the problem is, poodles think that every other kind of dog is just a really big, a really small, or a really fat poodle, when actually the other dogs aren't even poodles at all. They're terriers, or mastiffs, or greyhounds, or labs. And all of the thousands of different dog breeds have different lifespans and different health risks. Each one has evolved to use food differently for different specialties at surviving. Some for staying warm, some for running fast, and some for being strong. They're meant to be different sizes and weights. So the poodles think the mastiffs should lose weight, but a starving mastiff never becomes a poodle. The poodles don't understand that dogs come in many more sizes than they can imagine in their poodle-centric ways. So this becomes a problem when it comes to poodle science. When the poodles did their weight and health research and made their claim that lighter dogs are healthier and live longer, they weren't comparing thinner poodles and fatter poodles. They were comparing poodles and mastiffs. So the recommendation for mastiffs to lose weight is based on the false assumption that if all dogs reach poodle weight, then all dogs will have poodle health. But once again, a starved mastiff just isn't a poodle. This poodle science doesn't even test whether a starved mastiff lives longer than a mastiff who has enough to eat, because one would have to compare mastiffs who maintain poodle weight to mastiffs that maintain mastiff weight. And it turns out that starving mastiffs regain weight, which after all is a much better thing than starving. But the poodles can only see that regain as a failure of mastiff self-discipline. Look, poodles are great, but poodle-centric health policy is a nightmare. Good science tells us that it's better to recognize and respect the ways we're different, because how we're treated, having good friends, having access to decent food, a place to play, restful sleep, and medical care make a huge difference in our health and longevity, for all of us, whatever our size.
Yeah, I definitely encourage you to check out kind of OSDA and some of the resources listed at the end of that video, and I'll show more resources later. But I just want to take a quick moment to answer someone's question who asked kind of, I guess, why use the word disordered to describe eating, or why use the words eating disorder? And yeah, I don't necessarily think that someone with an eating disorder has anything like wrong with them, or that they need to be like fixed, or that I certainly don't think medication is always the answer. But I do think it's disordered as a society. It's really incredibly disordered that we tell people to metaphorically like to cram their feet into small shoes, to that we tell you know, big dogs to be tiny poodles. to use kind of the metaphor from the video, that we basically tell people to starve themselves and to be malnourished just so that they can fit and conform to what we think of as healthy or beautiful or whatever. So I do think it's important to call that out as disordered and to kind of look at it from that social standpoint as opposed to a medical standpoint. Next slide, please. So this is the next principle of health at every size. It involves support for health policies that improve and equalize access to information and services, and personal practices that improve human well-being, including attention to individual physical, economic, social, spiritual, and other needs. Hayes really recognizes that while individual behaviors such as nutrition, substance use, exercise, et cetera, like all of that accounts together for 25% of health outcomes, only 25%, not the majority. Social determinants such as income, race, gender, access to resources, et cetera, those account for 50% of health outcomes. So Hayes really says that social justice and equity are crucial to health enhancement. And what is not health enhancing at all is weight stigma or shaming people for their weight. Next slide, please. This is another principle. It's acknowledging our biases and working to end weight discrimination, weight stigma, and weight bias. So it means providing information and services from an understanding that socioeconomic status, race, gender, sexual orientation, age, and other identities impact weight stigma, and supporting environments that address those inequities. So that means policy change, just gender-affirming healthcare, free healthcare, accessible healthcare, and just healthcare that recognizes the impact of all of that. Next slide, please. And Hayes is really about eating for well-being, and that means eating based on hunger, satiety, nutritional needs, and pleasure, rather than any externally regulated eating plan that focuses on weight control. This is commonly referred to as intuitive eating. I really encourage people to look that up if you're interested. Hayes emphasizes that all foods fit, and demonizing any foods or food groups can lead to disordered eating. So really taking away this overly simplistic notion that some foods are healthy and some foods are unhealthy, or some foods are good, some foods are bad, but really looking at all foods have nutritional content that our body needs. We all need starch, fat, protein, fruits, vegetables, et cetera. And all food has some combination of that. So there's no food that's, 100% unhealthy and going to lead us to die instantly. And also, we're all going to die anyways. So this idea that we need to somehow kind of protect our health forever and ever through eating healthy, that doesn't work in the end. Next slide. And then life-enhancing movement is the final principle. It means engaging in enjoyable physical activities to the degree that feels comfortable for you. It's about moving your body for pleasure and mental and physical health benefits rather than to compensate for or earn food or to burn calories. So this is really doing away with the notion that exercise is always this inherently good thing, or that, that you need to exercise, that you're obligated to be healthy or have self-discipline, because ultimately, like, holding yourself to really rigid standards around exercise or doing it compulsively or making your self-esteem revolve around that, that's not healthy either. So what is healthy is pretty much anything you enjoy, I guess within reason, but that's not harming others, but anything you enjoy that brings you pleasure, that feels good to you, that's generally healthy for you. So if that's, walking, if that's just sitting and resting for a long time, however you want to move or not move, or just be with your body, is good. And it's totally fine. So that's really what this principle is about. Next slide. So this is really kind of summarizing that eating for pleasure principle. It's looking at eating based on your own body and your own internal wisdom versus external cues. So basically, external authority asks us to ignore internal cues in order to achieve that authority's version of a good body. So that could be fitness tech, data, comparison to other bodies, body measurement scales, BMI, things like that. Internal authority asks us to learn to pay closer attention to our body and its needs in order to develop trust between the mind and body. And I don't even like the phrasing mind and body, to be totally honest. Like, I think with my whole body, like if I'm depriving my body of carbs, like my husband, he's in the background watching and he'll join for a little exercise we're gonna do in a minute, but he will tell you that I am the most irritable, grumpy, like awful person to be around. So my whole body is like a part of my cognition, I think. And it, if I am fully nourished, then there's a lot of things that become available, a lot of like new thoughts and ideas and passion and joy that become just available to me. So even this idea of separating the mind and body at all through like language, I don't necessarily agree with, but listening to our internal authority helps us develop trust of our bodies. The cues that we can listen to are hunger and fullness, inner wisdom, energy level and strength. Like some foods give people more energy than others, and that's really different for every person. So just kind of learning about that, being willing to listen to what that might be for you, that can all be really helpful. Next slide, please. So some of the benefits of the Hayes approach are that it fosters body acceptance and self-compassion, which have proven mental and physical health benefits for everyone. It reduces discrimination and false generalizations made on the basis of body size. It decreases disordered eating behaviors, and it increases access to healthcare and quality of life for people of all sizes. Next slide, please. So just to speak more about kind of that tie between Hayes and body peace and liberation, kind of ending that war with our bodies. Hayes is about fostering body trust, i.e. the knowledge that our bodies are okay as they are, and that we can rely on our body's own cues to navigate eating and movement rather than external mandates and norms. It's about honoring the innate wisdom of our bodies. And I just wanna say this translates to so much more than food. Like I think for me, it a lot of times starts with food, because without a nourished body, it can be really hard to think clearly or pay much attention to almost anything. But with a nourished body, I've started to learn how to trust my own bodily cues, and but not only around food, but around just everyday life. That like sometimes if I'm feeling really angry, like about an interaction that I had that felt maybe sexist or fatphobic or ableist, I'll like listen to my body and I'll like feel the anger in my body's own way that it experiences anger. I'll just listen to myself and I might speak out or say something, or I might post on social media to educate people about those things. I've kind of moved from like, it used to be that someone would say something fatphobic and instead of listening to kind of my body's reaction to that, I would just be like, okay, the world is really fat phobic and only thin people are loved and I need to engage in disordered eating. I need to restrict my food as much as possible and try to lose weight. And now I kind of have this approach of like, yeah, like I'm feeling like angry about this. I can feel like my heart racing and I'm just having a lot of thoughts about how much better the world would be if I didn't have to deal with this BS right now. And I'm going to go write a blog post about that. And so I think this philosophy just kind of translates to life. Sometimes it means just like, I'm going to take a break from schoolwork. I'm a busy grad student. I'm going to take a break from schoolwork to watch some TV or whatever. It's just about like listening to myself. Next slide, please. This is just a little poem that I wanted to share. Today, I asked my body what she needed, which is a big deal considering my journey of not really asking that much. I thought she might need more water or protein or greens or yoga or supplements or movement. But as I stood in the shower, reflecting on her stretch marks, her roundness where I would like flatness, her softness where I would like firmness, all of those conditioned wishes that form a bundle of never quite rightness, she whispered very gently, could you just love me like this? And for me, that really summarizes what Haze is all about. Next slide, please. Okay. These are just quotes from a dietitian, Hazeline dietitian and therapist that does a lot of great work, Alice Baker, that I just thought were really important and speak to kind of the powerful impact of learning to trust your body. What our culture calls discipline around food and our bodies is actually violence. Each time you eat what you truly want and need, you are strengthening your authentic sense of self. So I thought these really capture kind of the contradiction between Haze and the conventional paradigm, that on one hand you have violence and war and distrusting yourself, and on the other hand you have being who you authentically are. Next slide, please. So here are just some suggestions for incorporating Haze into your life. You can challenge any misconceptions you have about what weight indicates about your or others' character, self-discipline, or health status. Start exploring what it would look like to eat and move for satisfaction and enjoyment rather than to change or control your body weight. Work to appreciate your body as a fundamental part of you rather than as an object that needs to be changed. Follow fat activists on social media. Read and share the work of fat and weight inclusive healthcare professionals, researchers, and writers. And I'll suggest some of those toward the end. Next slide, please. So if you want to share this in the chat, I don't know if we'll have time to read the responses, but if you want to just start thinking about this, maybe share if it comes to mind, what is one way that you can incorporate Haze principles into your own life? And next slide. And what is, this is just another question to think on. This is kind of just a way to get started. What is one thing that you appreciate about your body that has nothing to do with how it looks, or even necessarily how it functions? Just like anything you appreciate about your body. I know I just appreciate that my body allows me to exist and like be here in this space with all of you, speaking about something that's really incredibly important to me, and that it allows me to be connected to you and hear what you're all saying through kind of reading what is in the chat and everything. And someone just said my laughter, and I just really love that. I know when I was really restricting at one point and just engaging in a lot of disordered behaviors, I felt like nothing was funny anymore. Like I literally just was like, nothing makes me laugh. And when I started to engage in that process of just nourishing my body again, suddenly like I found myself laughing again. And that was just so nice that I kind of had that gift. Next slide, please. So this is an activity. We just have a few more minutes before questions. This is one of the principles of Haze is joyful movement. So it's kind of the idea of just moving however you want to move. So I'm going to play a song, and I invite you to move however feels right to you without any judgments, or just trying to avoid judgments if you can. If you want to just tap your foot or tap your fingers, if you want to stand up and like sway, if you want to like stand up and dance, if you want to just like dance from your chair, like anything. If you want to sit totally still and be just like completely mindful and close your eyes and enjoy the music, do that. It is all super great and super valid. And this song was written by someone in eating disorder recovery, Debbie Merkel, and I really appreciate her giving me permission to use it. So if you can play it, my husband will be joining me to dance. Indulging in that and engaging in that activity. I hope maybe you notice something about just being able to move in a way that's like how you want and not be beholden to a standard of like what's going to burn the most calories or something like that. And feel free to share that reflection. Next slide, please. I think I just have some resources. Yeah. Feel free to take a screenshot of these, look them up. These are great. These are life-changing. I really recommend them. Next slide. And also please feel free to take a screenshot of these. These are really great activists and professionals to follow, who have a ton of amazing things to say about Hayes. A lot of them are fat, so they can speak much more to me, much more than I can, about what it's like to live in a larger body and face fat phobia. So I just really encourage you to follow these names. I think we can now take some time. I think we have a little bit of time for some Q&A. Oh, I think someone wants to go back one slide, maybe. You want to leave that up? Okay. So yeah, I think we have some time for Q&A.
Yes, we have a couple of questions. One of them here is, I get folks who come to me and they always want to lose weight. I would prefer they focus on wellness and being comfortable with themselves. How do you suggest I move the conversation to health at every size and not so weight focused?
Yeah, I think that's hard. And I hear that question a lot from dietitians and therapists. And I'm just entering the field, so I'm sure I'll learn more approaches. But I think a lot of the resources that were just up could be good to just kind of encourage people to read, see what they think of it. Just ask if they would be open to an alternative viewpoint about weight and health and maybe some of the consequences of weight loss. I'm a really big fan of showing people the Minnesota starvation experiment. That's an experiment that kind of shows some of the consequences of significant weight loss and what that does to the body and mind. I think a lot of people in eating disorder recovery will cite that experiment as like getting them to realize that maybe what they were doing wasn't so conducive to their well-being or happiness. So that might be a good way to open the conversation if the person is kind of open to it. But I also think it's important to acknowledge that like our society treats thin people better, and there's real like systemic oppression against fat people, and the desire to lose weight is natural. It doesn't mean something is wrong with them. And so I think there's a way to see it as valid without necessarily saying, you know, that's what's healthiest or condoning it.
Thank you. We have another question here. Would you consider binge eating an addiction?
No. I really appreciate that question because I think food addiction and the concept of it is just so incredibly pervasive in these in embodiment spaces. But there's really good evidence to show that binge eating comes from restriction, that it's a natural reaction to that, no matter what size you are. If you're not getting enough nourishment, if you're not getting enough calories, your body's gonna rebel and you're gonna eventually likely binge. And that's really a good thing in a lot of ways. Like it can be like important for survival that you get that. Again, I would encourage reading the Minnesota Starvation Experiment. That's kind of a group of people who were super psychologically healthy or declared that by a lot of researchers, had never had any issues with food. They were put on, their calories were basically halved. And by the end of it, they were all engaging in like binge eating behaviors, eating in secret. And that lasted for years. There were some that continued to eat 10,000 calories or more for like years after the experiment. So I just think that that's good evidence that at least some of the time binge eating is from restriction. There's also good evidence showing that food only provides like a real value of like comfort or numbing when someone has a history of restriction. That if someone doesn't have a history of restriction, food doesn't hit the same like pleasure centers in the same way. And so the idea that food can be abused like a drug, like I think that that's just really mistaken. And it's really important to kind of look at some of the science showing how and why people might gravitate toward quote overeating or quote binge eating. And how that often results from restriction.
And I think there is another question. Well, maybe it's a comment. I'm trying to look through the Q&A here. A person choosing a hunger strike in response to trauma, suggestions what not to do or what to help focus on?
In response to trauma, I am not totally, I don't know that I've heard of like hunger strikes being done, I guess, in response to like interpersonal or individual trauma. I know they're sometimes carried out for political purposes. And I guess I would just say a lot of people consult with like dietitians or physicians before that. They kind of have a plan going in of when the end date will be or how to do it safely. I think maybe there's harm reduction approaches to eating disorders that honestly could probably be borrowed or shared knowledge by people going on hunger strikes. I don't know too much about it, but it's definitely an interesting area. In terms of trauma, I guess I haven't heard of that connection, but I'd be interested in hearing more.
Okay. And I think that that is the questions that I see here so far. I hope I'm not missing any. There's one. How do you define the use of food to numb, escape alcoholics abuse alcohol? Is not this kind of food use abuse, not a disease, but an addiction to the behavior?
No, I would define it as likely resulting from restriction. Obviously, I can't know that in every case, but just in my experience, from what I've seen, from the work I've done, from the research I've done, from the researchers I've talked to, I do know that restriction is underlying that, and that often when people stop restricting, when they truly eat enough, which may be more than what some calorie calculator on the internet or some healthcare professional says that they need, but when they truly eat like enough for their body consistently, and that might mean binging for a little bit, that might mean eating like a lot to kind of I guess compensate for all the restriction that's been done, that a lot of times I've heard the binging stops, the using food as comfort that lessens. So I think that's really important to look at, and also emotional restriction or shaming yourself for eating food, that can also cause kind of a binging reaction of your body being like, oh, are we going to go on a diet, like almost preparing for famine and trying to binge. So when people, I know other professionals have found that when people address restriction and societal messaging around certain foods and around their weight, that often it's no longer an issue.
We have another question here. Hypoglycemia causes me to need to be very strict and regulated. How do I engage this new theory within this? It's a really good question.
Thank you. Yeah, I am not a dietitian and cannot give dietary advice or therapeutic advice. What I would really recommend is seeing a Health at Every Size aligned dietitian, if that's available to you. ASDA, the Association of Size Diversity and Health, as well as I think the Intuitive Eating website, they have directories of dietitians who offer that. I would really recommend trying to see someone. There's people who offer sliding scale rates, because from what I've heard, people with hypoglycemia or other conditions where they have to be strict around food or they have to be more vigilant, it can often become much more about like the approach that is often used by like Hayes dietitians. It's more about adding things in. So if you're gonna have cookies, having milk with it, or having peanut butter, like a fat or something, adding in some nuts, like just creating more balance rather than restricting, because restricting again can lead to that binge cycle and can lead to all sorts of health issues. So again, I can't give dietary advice, but I would recommend kind of seeing a professional who's aligned with this paradigm, who could maybe give more specific direction. If that's not available, there are so many different like Hayes Facebook groups, Hayes forums, that I think if you were to join one and post or look at the other post, there might be people who kind of are sharing and supporting each other.
And I'm just going to sneak in one last question because we've had so many now towards the end. How do you feel about intermittent fasting?
How do you think I feel about intermittent fasting? Not good. I feel that any form of restriction, which is any kind of listening to external rules over listening to your own body, is harmful. And I think that some people naturally like are just not really like breakfast eaters. Their body just isn't hungry around that time or whatever time. Okay. But if it's like an intentional form of like restriction, and it usually is for weight loss, then that's harmful. And I guess I just want to ask any insert, what do you think of any diet here? What I would ask someone is, what do you still go on X diet, still do X thing, if it caused you to gain weight? And if the answer is no, then I think your motives are fairly clear that it's not necessarily about like just health, or it's not necessarily about like, oh, I'm just doing this to feel good. Like it's, there's a motive there that's about weight loss.
Thank you so much, Shira, for bringing this very, very important and very interesting and informative topic to the conference. Just looking at the chat, there's been so much conversation and sharing going on. And also, thank you for sharing your personal story. And also looking at the chat, this is a topic that hits home for many, many, many people. So thank you very, very much for bringing it here. Just a few announcements before we give our final word to our speaker today. If you would like to continue the discussion that's been going on in the chat, you can do that by going into the coffee break feature into the portal, which would be at the embodimentconference.org portal. You can also go to the Facebook group to continue this discussion. And of course, Shira's website, just see if I can copy and paste that into the chat right here. You can find out more at Shira's website. And if you enjoyed the talk, and if you enjoyed the slides and some of the animations in the slides, you can own the library if you want to by purchasing it. It is right now 50% off of the regular price for the duration of the conference. And it also includes summaries, cheat sheets, as well as audio only versions for people who like to listen to podcasts. It is useful when you want to watch and digest things at your own pace. There's 1,000 different speakers and presentations, so there's quite a lot there to watch. And of course, purchasing the library is something that helps make the conference accessible to everyone and for it just to be free for those who can't afford to purchase the library. So consider doing that. And once again, thank you so much, Shira, for coming here today and just bringing this topic and stimulating so much discussion and sharing here. And at this point, we're gonna give you the final word and kind of take it back to you to share your top tip on how to stay embodied.
So I just wanna thank everyone so much for coming and engaging in the discussion. And my top tip is really to just stop thinking of your body as separate and as a project that needs to be improved and tweaked and worked on, and just start thinking of it as you. Like, we are our bodies, they are us, and our bodies have knowledge and wisdom that should be listened to.